During Jesus' ministry, he performed many miracles, but only one of them is told in all four Gospels. Which one is it? Welcome to Probe. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for today, and with me are my conversation partners, Paul Dibdahl and Bruce Johansson from the School of Theology. I'd like to toss that question out and see if these men know which one we're talking about.
Probably for most of us, if we tried to think, you know, what's the most amazing miracle, we would think of maybe a resurrection that Jesus performed, raising someone from the dead. But the only miracle which appears in all four Gospels is the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000.
That's the only one.
That's the only one.
It's amazing. And it's really intriguing when you go to a synopsis of the gospel, and if you really want some fun exploring the Bible, take a synopsis and compare the parallel stories. Mm-hmm. Because in this case, they're shaped quite differently. In the synoptics, for example, Jesus is running away from the crowds.
Yeah.
Wants some rest. And when he gets there, here are all the people. Mm-hmm. And so, well, let's go ahead and feed them. See? In this case, also, the people are ready to make it after the miracle. They're ready to make him king, but that's only mentioned in John.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only in John where Andrew says, here's a little boy with five loaves mm-hmm. and two fish. And then Jesus takes that and multiplies. Now, a question I think is just kind of a practical one. Jesus had the amazing ability to produce food on command. But he didn't do it very often. And when he did, he didn't produce a fabulous banquet.
It was pretty staple food.
Pretty staple food.
Barley loaves.
Barley loaves and a couple of fish. Yeah. And he did it apparently at a time of human need. Hmm. He saw these people hungry.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about the nature of Jesus' miracles? I mean, he performed lots of miracles, but carefully. Sporadically, here mm-hmm. and there.
Mm-hmm.
Why does Jesus do that?
I personally think that all of Jesus' miracles, with the exception of the cursing of the tree, the fig tree, between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, every one of them is an act of grace reaching out to people's need. Every one of them really preaches God's grace. We focus on the miraculous, and we forget to ask, what is the meaning? What is he doing?
But one of the things that our age really struggles with, and we didn't have time to talk about this last week when we were talking about the man at the Pool of Bethesda, how Jesus picked only one man mm-hmm. out of all those, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if Jesus is gracious and kind and good,
mm-hmm.
why in the world doesn't he heal more people?
Mm-hmm.
Just to heal this one man?
Yeah.
And then just to heal on this one occasion? Now, there's the feeding of the 7,000 on another occasion.
Yeah.
But why doesn't Jesus come down and steamroll the world with marvelous gifts of grace and food every time he turns around?
You know, I mean, I'm here kind of listening and sort of shaking my head. I think that's the question that probably all of us have asked at some time or another, and for some people, it is probably the question that they ask. Mm-hmm. Why is it that it's sometimes, and we believe, yes, Jesus can do these things, but why doesn't he? Why doesn't he do them more consistently, or when it seems like clearly he should?
Now, what often happens in our modern world, I find people struggling with the question of fairness.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember some striking examples from our college family here, where we had three students that were in Africa that were supposed to be taking a 747. I've forgotten which airline it was. They were booked, ready to go. And when they went there, their names weren't on the list. They talked a blue streak, but no, they couldn't get on that plane. That plane went down.
Hmm.
And I remember being in our Sabbath school discussions as we had the prayer sharing time. And yet, the question came up, well, what about those people who were on that plane?
Yeah.
See?
And we have had students.
Oh, yes.
I'm thinking of one just recently who did go down in
yes.
a plane.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's impossible, at least I would hope it would be impossible, to come up with a formula and say that if you are right with God, you get what you pray for.
I've tried this with classes before, because I think most people believe that Jesus does I think God does act in a miraculous mm-hmm. way, even in the world today. I think most Christians certainly would believe that. But we also recognize that it doesn't seem to happen consistently or predictably. And I've, with classes before, tried to come up with a system on what basis, you know, what would work? The goodness of the person who's asking, their faith. You just go on down the list. None of them, if you follow them through, none of them will work. You end up just saying, God decides, mm-hmm. and we can't, I certainly can't pretend to understand exactly why.
The one conclusion that is often popular in our modern world is one that I don't find satisfying at all, although I can see its attractiveness. Rabbi Kushner, when bad things happen to good people, when his son was born with early aging disease, progeria, mm-hmm. and ended up dying at about age 15, it was so difficult for him to see how a good God could allow that to happen that he took the step of saying, yes, God is a good God, but he is powerless to intervene in our world. He's a good listening ear, but he's incapable of intervening. I'd much rather preserve the sense of mystery and allow God to intervene. I think that's a much more mm-hmm. biblical mm-hmm. position.
Yeah.
And
he has the final answer, but in between, we probably don't have the eyes or the brain to understand.
Right.
My approach to that is every good thing comes from God. Now, what I think is good every time may not be really good, but I'm just going to say I'm going to lay all the good things at God's feet and all the evil things come from sin. And I just leave it there.
Yeah. You know, just today I was looking at an email a friend of mine had passed on, actually from Philip Yancey, but came originally from Paul Tournier. He says, what's so amazing in our world is not that God can bring good out of good, but that God can bring good out of evil. Mm-hmm. And he says, our task here is to see, to bring mm-hmm. to the world's attention mm-hmm. how God can bring out of good. He says, if you had to bring good out of good, you'd soon run out of raw materials.
Yeah.
But if you can see how God can bring good out of evil,
yeah.
And I don't know how many people I've talked to who admit privately with some pain, the really important things that they have learned have come from the really difficult times.
That's right.
Yeah. And I kind of hate to admit it. I wish it were otherwise, but I look at it and I look back with gratitude and I say, marvelous that mm-hmm. you know, you took that what seemed to be a great disappointment and worked through it. So here we have a very ordinary feeding and just kind of an occasional one. Let's look at some of the symbolism involved here. Because right after this deliverance, I mean, right after this feeding, you have an example where the people were ready to take it, make him king, mm-hmm. according to John. Mm-hmm. Jesus went in the mountains. The disciples went back home.
I think the people caught on to some of the symbolism here. It was in a wilderness place. It was a feeding. It was a feeding of a large body of people. The connections with manna in the wilderness just seemed to be there. And I think John also brings it out the way he tells it, what Jesus says there. You have 12 baskets left. You've got 12 apostles.
The 12 tribes.
Yes. And I think there's a message here, not just simply for his wider audience, but I think there's a message for his disciples. Philip was counting up how much it would cost to feed all these people. And then Jesus does it, and afterwards, the baskets are overflowing, you know,
uh-huh.
and it was done free. I think he's prodding them to say, you know, if you believe, God will make your ministry powerful and abundant. You will be a new Israel. Mm. And you will grow and you will multiply. Mm. I think those kinds of messages are there in the background.
Now the other symbolism here, and John doesn't develop this nearly as much as some the synoptics do. The disciples ran into really rough water, a major storm, and as John reports it, Jesus comes, boom, it's
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the synoptics, you have a lot more anguish. You have Peter trying to walk on the... But it's just... It is deliverance at sea, which is yeah. another interesting parallel
yeah.
with the wilderness, deliverance at sea, and you have those yeah. bits and pieces.
The bridge over troubled water.
Bridge over troubled waters. Okay. Now, when you get back to the other side, this is there's a fairly significant piece in John's Gospel where Jesus tries to unpack the real meaning of this bread of life, and he makes some very shocking statements. One that, you know, I'm a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jesus uses cannibalistic language.
Yeah.
Eat my flesh and drink my blood. What in the world? Can't Jesus be a little more kosher than that?
Yeah.
Well, it's even, I think, more shocking for a Jew with their, you know, their laws in terms of partaking of blood.
Mm-hmm.
We are, even if we're not a vegetarian, if we're not a vegetarian, we probably aren't too concerned about mm-hmm. the amount of blood. Mm-hmm. But for the Jews to think of taking blood would just be would be terrible for them.
Yeah. The life is in the blood, you know.
Now, Bruce, you've done quite a bit of work on the background here, the historical background. Why in the world does John choose to use such forceful illustration, such forceful language?
Yeah, it's a interpretive guess against the background of what's going on in the world that John lived in. Mm-hmm. If we take Ephesus as the place of his ministry, there was I like both. This is a double-edged sword. I think what Paul has brought out here about the Jewish mind is definitely there.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you had people with a very dualistic way of thinking who tried to turn Jesus, they were Christian Gnostics who tried to turn Jesus into purely a revealer, his death not having taken place and having no saving efficacy. You are saved by knowledge. Your spirit is pure and good. Your body is evil and nasty, and therefore we need to get rid of it. And there is a guess here, and I think it's a fairly pertinent one, that when John reports what Jesus says, he puts it into language that would be very clear to those people that the death, the real body and the flowing blood of Jesus have saving action.
Mm.
It's not like you're going to eat and drink it, but you have to participate in the saving death of Jesus.
Now, John follows up here and says, as a result of these shocking words, many of his disciples went no more with him. And so this was a turning point.
It was a turning point.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a sign, it was a negative sign in language, you could almost say, and it didn't meet with faith.
Hmm.
It was very troubling. And I think that's where Paul's words come in very well. A Jew would just be recoil in horror at this kind of language.
Right. For me, two verses that are just really touching here. John 6:66. You know, says many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. And then Jesus questioned in verse 67, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" Jesus asked the 12. And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go?"
That's most poignant.
That is very moving to me, very touching. To whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, Peter says.
In fact, if you look at the whole of chapter 6, it starts off with references to the disciples, and it ends up with references to the disciples. Mm-hmm. I think the feeding of the 5,000 was a challenge to have faith. It was a comfort that he would take them over troubled water.
Yeah.
And here at the end, when many leave them, he again comes to them, and those few reaffirm their faith in him.
And the message that he wants to leave again is that the signs may fail, but you can still trust in him.
That's right.
Thank you, Bruce and Paul. Next week, we're going to move into the Good Shepherd story. And we'll have the same conversation partners. My thanks to Jim Bryson, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at the same time for Probe.